you have three very interesting people that you profile in the generals. And I guess let me start with Patton, because General Patton, it seems the way you describe him, this is a guy that was made to fight. He was singularly focused, and he seemed to have this sense of destiny about him. Is that a fair characterization?
It sure is. Patton was the richest man in the Army. I mean, he didn't need to be in the Army. But he would go, these far-flung outposts when he was a young lieutenant, a captain, and he'd arrive on a post with a string of polo ponies and a yacht. And the other officers didn't begrudge him that because he happened to be the finest horseman in the Army, and he was one of the finest sailors. As a matter of fact, he was in the 1912 Olympics. That was the pentathlon. And they had like six or seven different tests that they used. Riding and shooting and swimming and sword fighting and track and field, so forth. One of his best was swimming, and he was a great swimmer because he learned to swim around Catalina Island, which his family owned. So he was a very interesting guy. He was dyslexic, and the way he got around that was he would memorize whole math problems and literary essays. And that's the way he got through West Point. But it was a struggle for him. But he got through it pretty well. As you say, he was born to fight. And fight he did.
And so you have this hard-charging personality, but yet he wrote poetry?
He did. Some of it's not bad. Some of it's actually pretty good. Some of it is bad. But again, he'd write limericks if he wanted to. He found a way to express himself that way.
With this personality of his, it seems like he was getting in trouble, or at least causing problems for his superiors.
He was a trial for his superiors.
Well, and I think Eisenhower, I'm paraphrasing here, but basically when Patton got into one of his dust-ups, Eisenhower basically said, yeah, this guy is over the top, but hey, he's a fantastic general.
Actually, Marshall said that more than Eisenhower. Eisenhower was perplexed because he was getting bad publicity in the press, in American press, and he stuffed that would reflect badly on General Marshall and on President Roosevelt and on himself. Both MacArthur and Patton had great egos, and Marshall had practically no ego. And when Eisenhower laid the problem of Patton on Marshall's door, Marshall realized that Patton was indispensable. I mean, he was truly a fighting general, and he was not going to let him get fired. And the same was true with MacArthur, and I think that Marshall really didn't like MacArthur, but in all the trouble MacArthur caused him, he kept him in the fight. I think it's to General Marshall's great credit. And he did one of the most selfless things I think has been done in those times, which was that he could have appointed himself to the role that he appointed General Eisenhower. He was the chief of staff. And that's all he ever wanted to do was control a big army and fierce combat. And that was the fiercest that they were going to have, is to invade across the English Channel into France. President Roosevelt asked him, didn't tell him, order him, but simply asked him, tell him he'd prefer him to stay around in Washington, and that's what General Marshall did for the good of the service and for the good of the president. I thought that's pretty selfless.
One other thing I wanted to ask about Patton is it seems when he was fighting in World War II, he always wanted more supplies. He couldn't be supplied enough. And you describe one story where he used a stone soup-like tactic to make sure that he had what he needed on the battlefront. Could you tell me that?
It was a parable of some sort that he had learned from back in the Depression days. What he would do was they weren't giving him the gasoline. What he basically needed was fuel, because his army was a tank army, mostly mechanized. So what he would do was he would get as close to the enemy as he could, and then start a fight. And he knew that the headquarters, Eisenhower's headquarters, doesn't want to cut off a person in a fight. And so they would start sending supplies. And so he compared that with, during the Depression, a hobo goes to somebody's back door and he knocks and a woman comes out and he says, he's got a bowl there. He says, he's making rock soup. He's got some water and he's got some rocks in the bottom of it. And he said, maybe can I have a piece of an onion, and she gives him a piece of the onion. And he comes back and says, it sure would taste better with maybe a carrot. And so she gives him the carrot, and then finally he says, if you don't have any spare pieces of meat, you might put in there to eat that rock soup.
Well, you said that MacArthur had a large ego as well, just like Patton. But it seems that MacArthur was a little bit different, and there was an eccentricity about him that you didn't have with Patton.
Well, both of them are pretty doggone eccentric. But, MacArthur was, he was the youngest general in World War I. He was the youngest superintendent of the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. He was the youngest chief of staff of the Army, which he was for a long time. Then, of course, he left the Army and went to be the major domo, whatever it is, the field marshal of the Philippine Army, because the president of the Philippines had said to him, "Can you make me an army that can withstand the Japanese?" And MacArthur said, "Well, it would take probably 10 years, but I'll try." And, of course, they ran out of time. And once the Pearl Harbor broke out, Roosevelt had decided to make MacArthur the supreme commander in the Southwest Pacific. And he was a long way from home, and he could do things that he might not have gotten away with earlier. But he was so furious about it, he went to the press about it, was that he wasn't getting proper supply from Washington. He thought that Marshall and somebody there in the chief of staff's office just deliberately not supplying. What he didn't realize was that President Roosevelt and Winston Churchill had previously made a policy of what they called Germany First. I mean, we're going to send all the supplies we can to beat Germany, kind of hold off on the Pacific. We'd get to them later. He was justly, I think, incensed about that. He didn't know about it at the time.
MacArthur did have that long association with the Philippines. You know, he had been in the Philippines before World War II. How do you think that shaped his outlook, his views?
Well, it certainly shaped his views when it came to pass. You know, when he left the Philippines, he was ordered off the island because the Roosevelt administration did not want him captured and probably dragged through the streets of Tokyo in chains or hung or whatever, hanged or whatever they do to you. Everybody knows the story of the PT boat, and they finally got him to Australia, where he assumed command of what was then a skeleton army. When he left the Philippines, he said, "I shall return." And "I shall return" was put on coffee mugs and ashtrays and scrawled on the walls of latrines everywhere through America. It was a great line. He had vowed to go back there, and he was doing this island hopping and headed toward the Philippines. And suddenly, Admiral Nimitz decided that they had a different view, that the Navy was coming across the Philippines from the central Philippines, and MacArthur was coming up from the south. The Navy did not want to invade the Philippines. They wanted to leave it alone. This was a great to-do, and MacArthur went and met with President Roosevelt in Honolulu with the Navy, and they had a very long, sensible, polite conversation about it. And at the end of the day, Roosevelt agreed with MacArthur that they should go ahead and invade the Philippines. If he had never lived there for all those years, we might not have invaded the Philippines. The people badly suffering under the Japanese, which MacArthur, of course, knew.
Well, both Patton and MacArthur commanded troops, and even though they were these larger-than-life figures, you write that they had fairly different tactics on the battlefield. Can you explain that?
They were such different battlefields. MacArthur was faced with these really dreadful islands that were full of jungle, and, of course, you had to have amphibious landing. I think both men tried to save as many soldiers as they could, but both men had the outlook of probably General Sherman and General Grant in the Civil War, which is that you cannot be timid. You're going to lose men, and it's better to go ahead and lose them than to prolong the war, because the longer it's prolonged, you're going to lose men anyway. So in that sense, I think that they had they were like-minded in the overall strategy.
Well, turning to George Marshall, this is a guy who it seems like he was an organization man. That was his skill. And if you asked him to do it, he would do it. He didn't put up a fuss.
George Marshall, you know, he like Patton and like MacArthur, too, but he didn't have to be in the Army. After World War I, he had an offer, a great offer from J.P. Morgan, and I think he had another offer from another one of his big banking companies up there. He could have made millions, but he chose to stay in the Army. To his consternation, his organizational abilities always landed him in a staff job somewhere, where he really wanted to be out in the field with the troops. In the end, which is sort of interesting, military training does not always train the person for a great civilian career, because Marshall's civilian career was not really stellar. I mean, he, after the war, well, I'll tell you what was stellar, was the Marshall Plan, which was to restore, lend the money to restore Europe. I don't know what would have happened without that, but it's very probable that the Russian communists would have taken a lot more territory than they did. But after that, General Marshall became the Secretary of State, and so he took off his military hat, and he put on his diplomat's hat, and which are diametrically opposed. I mean, a military guy is there to fight. The diplomat is there to negotiate and not fight. And Marshall's problem was, I think he had been working with the Russians for 4 years, with the communists, and because they were our allies in World War II. But after that war was over, and after the Russians, the communist regime was safe, they suddenly became our enemies, and Marshall was very slow to recognize this. At the same time, the Chinese communists were active in trying to overthrow the regime of Chiang Kai-shek in China, and Marshall went out there for a year to try to solve the problem, and he tried to get the Chinese communist and the capitalist, the Chiang Kai-shek, to cooperate with each other, and it's simply impossible. It's like putting a cobra and a mongoose in a cage and expecting a different result. And he was a fascinating guy, and certainly was a credit to his country.
There are many who assume that Marshall would lead the Normandy invasion, that he was positioned for that. FDR didn't pick him. He picked Eisenhower, and Marshall just accepted it. What do you think that says about who he is, his character?
Marshall really could have picked himself for that if he wanted to. But what it says about Marshall is, I think, he, as I said before, he's selfless. He's, he would do what it took to move forward the war effort. And if it took him being in Washington, he knew his value, because that entire organization, Joint Chiefs of Staff, all allies, that could have broken down to squabbling and become a real mess. And he was the guy who held the glue. He was the glue that held it together. I got all the tape recordings that he made 3 or 4 years prior to his death. And he goes at some length in saying that he feared that, and he knew the president feared it. But he was chomping at the bit. He was like a racehorse putting a pin. He was chomping at the bit to get in that fight, but he realized he was more valuable where he was, and there he was.
All three of these men fought in World War I, but it seems that there was influence much earlier. You know, they were born after the Civil War, but it seemed like that legacy of the American Civil War kind of poked through in how they saw the military and how they thought of themselves within that.
They were 19th century characters. They were born in the 1880s. MacArthur, for instance, his father had won a Congressional Medal of Honor in Civil War and became a top general in the Army. But MacArthur grew up on the outpost far-flung in the West, in Texas and Arizona. And I mean, he remembers fighting between the Indians, and he remembers looking up and seeing flaming arrows go over the walls of one of the forts he was in. He said he'd learned to ride and shoot before he learned to read and write. Patton, of course, did not grow up. He grew up in a pretty luxurious life in California. But his grandfather had been killed in the Civil War. He was a Confederate general in Virginia. Marshall, I think, probably less, because he had some ties with his own father in a small battle in the Civil War in Kentucky. But I saw no real evidence that it had affected him, other than actually I think it might have affected him in an adverse way, because Marshall went to VMI.
Virginia Military Institute.
Virginia Military Institute. And he was from Pennsylvania. And at some point, the Institute invited down an old Confederate general who Marshall described as having given a speech that was almost victorious. You know, VMI then and now still has the cannonballs in its big wall that it has there. A whole bunch of cannonballs that were shot in it during the Civil War. They tend to attract Southerners. And I think Marshall was not a fan of the Confederate cause. Nevertheless, he'd been touched by it if he went to BMI in those days.
Well, in the preface of your book, you remark that generals don't do well outside of wartime. They don't do well in peacetime. And you write that perhaps that's because during war they become as close to gods on earth as we're likely ever to see. And I was thinking about conflicts today, military conflicts nowadays, and oftentimes they're against non-state actors, they're not against other countries. It's unmanned drones that are doing the killing. You have lawyers in the room right beside the generals. This idea of generals and military figures as superhuman figures, has that kind of passed us by now?
I don't know. We hadn't had a war to prove that theory yet. Thank God we haven't. But, I mean, I look back in modern, because I was in Vietnam, and I saw some pretty good generals. I saw a few bad ones. You know, General Schwarzkopf in that first Gulf War, now that was a real out front guy, and he amused the entire nation. People fascinated with him, and he won the war in what, about a week, I think. And then General Petraeus, to a lesser extent, in this last mess we had in Iraq. I think that doing any kind of large action, somebody's going to shine. One hopes so, but the value of guys to me like MacArthur and Patton and Marshall is that during a war, the people need to feel like that somebody competent is handling things. And we could have lost that war in the early 1942. We come as close to it as we needed to. And suddenly in the last part of 1942, General MacArthur started winning some big victories out in the Pacific, and General Patton started winning some big victories in North Africa and then later in Sicily. And General Marshall was in the news all the time because, of course, he was the chief of staff. He wore a nice uniform, all dressed with a lot of medals, and saw the press a great deal. The people, at least when you go back and read the papers, there seemed to be a calming influence. And knowing that their sons were being led by competent men.